Revolt Radio.
The ideology he opposed throughout his political life insisted that history was moved by impersonal tides and unalterable fates. Ronald Reagan believed instead in the courage and triumph of free men. And we believe it all the more because we saw that courage in him. As he showed what a president should be, he also showed us what a man should be. Ronald Reagan carried himself, even in the most powerful office, with a decency and attention to small kindnesses that also define a good life. He was a courtly, gentle, and considerate man, never known to slight or embarrass others. Many people across the country cherish letters he wrote in his own hand to family members on important occasions, to old friends dealing with sickness and loss, to strangers with questions about his days in Hollywood. A boy once wrote to him requesting federal assistance to help clean up his bedroom. The president replied that unfortunately funds are dangerously low.
Shut the hell up, boy George. This nonsense about Ronald the Crip Reagan carried himself with charisma and with decency. Is that how he carried himself when he carried those reefs in Germany to the tombstones of SS troops and placed them on it? That's decent, right? Look, let's just get this straight. Boy George, before Reagan's raggedy coffin is lowered into his pit, why don't you, your father, Barbara Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Colin Cancer Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Chalabi, Jerry Brown, Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, the Iraqi National Congress, Ariel Sharon, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, John Kerry, Armstrong Williams, Shelby Steele, John McWaters, the government of Israel, the government of Sudan, the government of the U.S., all Hebrew Zionists, all Islamic Zionists, all Christian Zionists, Bill O'Reilly, CIA, FBI, NYPD, OPD, LAPD, Rush Limbaugh, all the Supreme Court justices, Jeb Bush, Catherine Harris, and Crime Bill Clinton. Just get in that coffin with Ron the Crip Reagan. Y'all gonna be heading that direction in the first anyway. You know what time it is. Slayer time. You're listening to 104.1. 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, The World Slave Revolt Time. Tonight we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment. That's basically going to deal with that, from the issues to South Africa, from the issues of deviants like Ronald the Crip Reagan being created. We can't vote our way out of this madness. And then we got a commentary, possibly, if we have time, on old boy George. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1, Slave Revolt.
America. America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with the brotherhood of a select group of liars, cheaters, and thieves who use that brotherhood to form the most arbitrary and ambiguous history the world has come to know. Red, white, and blue, the symbolism of hypocrisy and bureaucratic stagnation. Men of power glossing the fault line cracks. In historical facts, red, white, and blue, those stars and stripes for never. Never again will I take a back seat, genuflect those my equal, sing that whining anthem or tatter my clothing with those tired ass colors. Blue. Blue is the mood that sweeps my emotions into a disastrousness of color me sad. Color me gray, color me gloomy when thinking of those colors, patriotic white. White are the ghost-faced pointed hoods swinging my ancestor from the tree that fed life back into earth to breed in abundance the fork-tongued serpent, erecting sacrilegious torches in the face of the phoenix who takes flight up out of the ash, leaving that glow in its dust, its winged fan spreading a shadow over hatred. And I see red. Red are my bloodshot eyes streaming tears down that flag shrouded in glory, glory, hallelujah. My country, 'tis of thee, waving embers across purple mountains majestic only to those who believe. While in the sky, atmospheric radiation beams down, singeing surf and turf, blistering the feet of the unprepared, running, running, running from those poisonous rays, seeking to alleviate your pain, taking your face with sunblock 2000, covering up your face, covering up your skin, covering up your history of bad blood and foul misinterpretations. Running from each other, running out of the frying pan and into the fiery douses of hell, and forever will you burn with those crosses of iniquity, and let those you've abused inherit your precious earth. So fly your flag in hell, still streaming down its acts of change and cover-up that have insistently been deemed necessary. And I will cry. Cry social injustice. Cry racism. Cry sacrilege. Cry freedom from sea to shining sea. My tears will not provide you with escape. And you, your pointed hoods and your smoking crosses shall burn forever, marching in the parade of hell's fire and brimstone.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know what time it is. I know many people have been hearing all of the hoopla in the corporate media about Ronald the Crip Reagan. And true to form, while we're going to somewhat deal with Crip's past and legacy, we're going to go about it my own eclectic roundabout way, in a sense. You know, what we're going to deal with is not just his complicity in helping the ruling class plunge the world, but the illusion that people have within a state system in thinking that having one rotten apple as opposed to another one, i.e. a Democratic rotten apple, as opposed to a rotten Republican one that Reagan represented, is somehow the solution. And how we're going to start off with this assessment and dealing with this concept is the South African question to start. You know, Father Michael Lappy, he's a white ANC member from South Africa. He lost one of his eyes and both of his hands, basically by the de Klerk regime sending him, or their death squad sending him, a package that blew up in his face and almost killed him. Now he's, you know, well, being a father, you know, a little, he's a mystic. Of course, a lot of his framing of the worldview is through the invisible man concept. But there's another mysticism going on, and it's how he and others think that they can reform a market system that is somehow going to overall benefit all of its citizens. This is what I mean when, in essence, I say that from America to South Africa, whether it's a Ronald DeCrip Reagan in office or a Mandela, we're not going to vote our way out of this madness. But first, let's hear what he has to say about the situation that was existing in South Africa and some of the things he had to face in the late 80s. And then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
I think it's good to think about what South Africa was like inside the country as well as what was happening in the frontline states at that time. During those years, there were two states of emergency. Vast numbers of people were imprisoned. It was during those years, and this is a salient point for people in this country this time, torture became normative. It became a principal weapon used by the apartheid regime against people, particularly against black children during that period. It was also a period where there were a vast number of people on death row in South Africa. Every Thursday, up to seven people at a time were executed. But it was also a time when the apartheid regime was on the rampage in the frontline states, attacking Botswana, Lesotho, Mozambique, Zimbabwe. There were a number of massacres of refugees that took place. It was also a time of civil war in Angola, and it was the Reagan administration that was supporting UNITA bandits in Angola and fomenting war. And it was very clear to the people of South Africa during those years that whilst there were a vast number of ordinary people in the United States, particularly African Americans, who stood with us, the Reagan administration was on the side of apartheid. And it was both Reagan and Thatcher who were giving succor to the apartheid regime. And in a sense, prolonging our struggle, more people had to die in South Africa because of the support that came from Western governments, particularly from Washington and London at that period.
All right. Now, you know, as you hear Father Michael Lappy lay out, you know, Reagan was complicit during a you know, a good period of South Africa's reign of terror and so on and so forth. Now, I know this is a time where people are throwing righteous ammunition at Ronald DeCrip, but let's get some things straight. UNITA really started to come into power in the mid-70s as John Stockwell, the former head CIA agent involved in Angola, documents In Search of Enemies. And old Carter and them were right in the middle of all of that type of rise to power during UNITA's genocidal campaigns with the South African government, with Israel, and with RENAMO. So let's, you know, look, I'll be the first one, as you've heard, shoot some bullets at Ronald DeCrip. I have no love or respect for that dog. But at the same time, let's not get caught up into this atmosphere of if we only move out those types like Ronald the Crip, everything can more or less be all right. Nah, it ain't gonna be all right.
Okay.
Now, it's true. Like, once again, when he said that, you know, during this apartheid period in the late 80s, torture became normative. But look, apartheid, they were trying to maintain their apartheid system. So torture did become normative. Right now in Iraq, the occupiers, the Christopher Columbuses with cowboy boots on, Sam, are trying to maintain their imperialist domination. So torture is normative. Right in the U.S., they're trying to maintain a social economic order. So if you go over to Chicago, what did you see? Frank Burge putting electrodes to black people's genitals and ears and cranking it up. Torture, normative. In other words, anywhere the market system is in existence and the ruling class, with a ruling class hell-bent, quite naturally, on maintaining that order, torture is normative. Now, the reason why I point this out is that often many of these liberal and, you know, mystic types want to get into this type of we can move steps ahead just by getting rid of some of these horrendous types of people who from time to time rise up in the system. The reality is that we have a market system that helps create and flourish these types of characters. They wouldn't exist if it wasn't for an imperial market order that helps produce this type of madness going on. These generals right now, some who are somewhat on the hot seat and, you know, so on and so forth, their role is to maintain and perpetuate U.S. imperial dominance. And with the resistance going as it is in Iraq, they are forced to, since they are the armed fist of the imperial order, to escalate their violence and their barbarity to maintain as much as possible for their masters the status quo. So if down the road you read about a particular general for the U.S. involved in incredible forms of barbarity in the Iraqi, you know, in some of these jails in Iraq, it's not because this particular person is so barbaric necessarily. It has more to do with the system that breeds and helps condition and nurture those people into those particular types of wavelengths.
And you know, brothers and sisters, I know you all been checking out this barrage, this U.S. news media's reaction to Ronald Reagan's death, and it's putting on display what has happened to American public debate in the years since Ronald Reagan's political rise. A near total collapse of serious analytical thinking at the national level. Across the United States, television dial and in major American newspapers, the commentary is absolutely fawning. They're just falling all over him, almost in a Pravda-like way, far beyond the normal reticence against speaking ill of the dead. Well, we hear Slave Revolt, we tell you right now, we don't like to talk about dead people unless it's good. He dead, good. Listen.
He's been dead for a long... Too bad it didn't happen 40 or 50 years earlier.
Well, that day, certainly. What Tracy was referring to earlier was officially called constructive engagement, and the South African that spoke is right. It did prolong apartheid. But to give you a real look at the character of this Reagan regime, I want to just point out the two things. Tracy talked about Mozambique and RENAMO and Angola and UNITA. These organizations claim to be liberation organizations that were fighting against the totalitarian pro-Soviet parties that were in power. We're talking Mozambique, that was FRELIMO, right? And then in Angola, that was the MPLA. Now, what do we know about RENAMO? Well, and what do we know about liberation outfits? If an organization really wants to liberate the people, the one thing it doesn't do is abuse the people. One of the things that Rene Mon was famous for was the terror it wrought against ordinary Mozambicans. Such things as cutting off people's ears. So I'm here to tell you, let's be clear, that's not a liberation organization. And let's look at UNITA for a minute, briefly. Angola is a country with among the highest amputees in the world.
Per capita.
That's right, per capita. That's correct. And that comes from the fact that UNITA utilized so many landmines that it's hard to sweep them all. Some of them are still active, unfortunately. So still today, children may be walking around and boom, your leg's off. That is not a liberation organization, brothers and sisters. No way.
Now next, Lapley talks about what the ANC called to the international community and how some of these things help bring down apartheid. So let's check out what he has to say and we'll take it from there. Dig this.
Well, the African National Congress of South Africa, leading the struggle in South Africa, was saying to the world, we will free South Africa. We ask the world to be in solidarity with us. So the role the international community had to play was to shorten that struggle, to mean that we would die less. And so in a way, the support, the economic support to apartheid meant the struggle lasted longer. It took us longer to achieve those fundamental rights.
Okay, you know, right when someone starts talking about ending apartheid and then that's free in South Africa, right there, your antenna should go up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, see, this is what I'm talking about, how these little pacifist liberal types, you know, and all of this type of stuff, they start mixing things together, which in many ways have no business being mixed together. Now, apartheid in many ways is like Jim Crow. It's a form of super exploitation of a particular group. But South Africa and Jim Crow are also like scaffolding. You use the scaffolding to build up the house of inequality, to put it into, you know, powerful privatized hands. Once the house has been built, you can take the scaffolding down. And the house of inequality, i.e. the market capital system that it was built upon, will stand firmly. This is what has basically happened in South Africa and, yes, in the U.S. You have a situation in South Africa where scores of people are being arrested for stealing water. Now, one would ask, how did this come about? Especially since in South Africa, they have particular laws that say that all South African citizens are to have free access to water, you know, and, quote, sufficient food and water, unquote. But the reality is that they've privatized and are privatizing much of the water. So you have a situation where once it gets into corporate privatized hands, which the apartheid system helped. This is what it helped set in foundation, the consolidation of a ruling particular class. So now apartheid is gone, but whites are 4-5% of the population during apartheid, they control 70-75% of the land. Whites are 4% of the population post-apartheid, they control 80% of the land. In other words, the fact that apartheid is gone, you know, just like the fact that Jim Crow is gone, quote unquote, officially, you know, by laws and all of that, does not mean that the economic social order still does not have apartheid-like situations. So in the year 2001, there was a massive cholera outbreak that spread all throughout various regions in the KwaZulu Natal province of Johannesburg. Hundreds of thousands were sick. Hundreds died. Now, what had happened was the cholera-infected water people ran to because they can no longer afford the privatized water. So here you have people who struggled to get rid of apartheid, but they're still dying from basic means. You have a situation where they got a thing called GEAR in South Africa, the Growth, Employment, and Redistribution that's set in South Africa. But what their program emphasizes is commercializing and privatizing all of South Africa's public companies and services. And what we've seen, even though they promised 120,000 new jobs in South Africa through its whole, formal sector of work, what you've seen is 100,000 jobs evaporate and 4 million people now employed in volatile, low-wage jobs. In other words, in essence, what I'm saying is it's through all of the smoke and mirror of South Africans, black South Africans, having the right to vote, they still are in horrendous conditions that through the privatization process, they have their own Ronald Reagan without it even being a Ronald Reagan. Actually, it was Mandela and some of these other Negroes. In other words, we aren't going to vote our way out of this madness.
That's right.
In essence, what I'm saying. And, he says that since we went basically through kind of a nonviolent route, it's still going to be longer to achieve other fundamental rights. Now, when he says that, one has to think, what are his priorities of fundamental rights? Because if it's just based in a kind of petty bourgeois, oh, I got the right to vote type of thing, and it's not a right for clean water, then something is off kilter. Something is seriously off kilter. Now, in the 1950s, you had the attack by, the civil rights activists and so on and so forth about the separate but unequal situations. We're in the year 2004. And when you look at the reports that have come out, even though the laws are not officially on the book, Jim Crow laws, the schools are still separate and unequal. The distribution of money going into a McClyman's is disproportionately lower than in a school like a Burlingame High. So the separate and unequal situations still exist because the market privatized order still exists. Whether it's a Reagan, a crime Bill Clinton, or Nelson Mandela. Now next, let's hear Lapley talk about his vision of recovery. And let's see if that's not unlike what many of these lesser of two evils, anyone but Bush, are throwing at us now. Check this out.
I was in hospital for about 7 months. That's the kind of the physical journey, but there's another kind of journey of coming to terms with having no hands. But I was very fortunate in that my pain and what happened to me was acknowledged, reverenced, and recognized by people around the world. And that enabled me to travel a journey from victim to survivor to victor. And that's in a way why I do the work I do now, to seek to walk beside others who have not had their pain acknowledged. And I think one of the very wonderful things you are doing in this program today is not simply acknowledging Reagan, everybody's doing that, but you're acknowledging the poor of the world who suffered under Reagan, and this great knowledge of what happened to unemployed, poor, homeless, African-American, Hispanic people, but by this very program, we are moving from knowledge to acknowledgement. And I think that in itself is one step on the journey to healing, acknowledging what happened to the ordinary people in those years and lifting up their stories, their pain, but also their faith and endurance and hope and commitment and giving it its rightful place at this time.
All right, now, basically that was this mystic garbly book. Because, you know, all this stuff of going from victim to survivor to victor. Now, compare that kind of, now, and this is what he's saying that he is in his situation. Now, look at it, compare that to someone like Che, who here Che, even though Che helped lead a successful revolution in Cuba, and Che's hands and everything else were intact, you know, he looked at the world order that was still going on, and he did not see himself or the masses of people fully being free, or the Cuban people fully being free, until there was a change of the private market Yankee order that was in existence. In other words, he knew that while the Cuban people's living standards were going up, especially compared to many of their Latin neighbors, that as long as there was a market order in existence, Cuba and much of the other region would continuously be under the threat of being destroyed until the market order itself was free and all of us can become true victors. Now, this guy has this kind of, you know, whole mysticism of, you know, if the people just, you know the truth and get to express themselves about some of the horrors that they've been through, as if they're not going to know about seeing their little kids hacked up, or, you know, their father being shot down by some clown who went to the School of the Americas, as if they're not going to know this reality. That this in itself is how you go from a victim to survivor to victor. No. The market capitalist class has to be destroyed. Otherwise, we'll just be spinning ourselves around and around. So it's not just about, in essence, what I'm saying, the clerk not being president anymore and apartheid not existing. Because the masses of people, especially black people in South Africa, are catching hell. They're in a dire apartheid situation. Even though the laws officially aren't in the group, in the book, the market order is putting them in just as much of a dire situation as they were in during the apartheid period. You have black people in desperate situations starting to shoot people off their farms and just occupying the land, similar to Zimbabwe. Now, if everything was going, quote-unquote, in the right direction in good old South Africa, obviously, this wouldn't be happening. But there's obviously something going on with this particular person's worldview of social order and victory.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, you know, I should have mentioned this. When I talked about those renegade tools of imperialism, that is Renamo and UNITA, I should have made it abundantly clear that they were both funded by the United States government. That is why. I mean, the nerve of these people to try to have their little orgy of congeniality and love for Reagan, and he was funding the likes of Renamo, cutting off the ears of Mozambique citizens, and UNITA, which caused so much damage to Angola, they still haven't dug their way out of it, even though they put him away recently. Thanks the Lord.
Talking about Savimbi.
Savimbi, I'm sorry. Savimbi, the leader of UNITA. Excuse me.
Now, next, let's hear how Lapley babbles on about what he calls restorative justice, and how He gave his story to the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa. And let's see if this restorative justice concept is not all that dissimilar to how some of these lesser of two evil Democrat types would have you believe. Needs to be done here. Check it.
I gave evidence to the commission, and whilst I had told my story many times, speaking to the commission had a very particular moral significance, because in a way I felt that my own story was becoming an indelible part of that great patchwork of the journey of the people of South Africa. And in a way, I would say, although I lost hands that I'll always grieve for, the greatest privilege of my life was to be part of perhaps the most important struggle of the 20th century, the struggle against apartheid.
Okay, once again, he says that this is perhaps the most important struggle of the 20th century, the struggle against apartheid. Okay, what do they really have to show for it? On the real, I mean, because has any country in Africa benefited from Africa's in chaos. From the Congo, 3 million black people have been incinerated by imperial-inspired forces in the Congo just in the last few years. Sudan in chaos, running amok with these National Islamic Front maniacs and stuff. You got region after region on fire. None of this and the relief, the destruction or the evaporation of the official apartheid system didn't help the African continent any more, in essence, than it overall helped the black people of South Africa. Because at the end of the day, having a vote and no one to vote for is not freedom. If the ANC, Mandela, and others are still beholden to a market order, then they will be Reagan-like. That's the reality. So here you have a situation where the ANC has been brutally repressive against protesters as a privatization, which went right hand in hand with unemployment. In the same way that when Ronald DeCrip came into office, he laid off or basically fired and handcuffed these air traffic controllers. In other words, the ANC, Thabo Mbeki, and Mandela did not act fundamentally different than how Reagan acted, because they were still beholden to the same ruling class. Now, you also have a situation where there has been an incredible large percentage of the South African population that has now been thrust into unemployment. Where does it hover around now? 50%. 50%. Now, that's not a success story. When you have a country that actually has a lot of people who have skills, industrial skills and other things, you have a mineral-rich country, you have a country where a large portion of the population has skills in textiles and so on and so forth, that 50% of the population is unemployed, and the 50% that is employed is under the gun by a social order that is privatizing them into a more and more horrendous situation, then quote-unquote having a vote is not in itself what you would call any form of true freedom. So so he's talking in a lot of symbolisms is in essence of what I'm saying. And what we have now is Africa is in turmoil. The Mideast is in turmoil. South America is in crisis. And Imperial Sam is running around the planet pushing its imperialist wills on anyone that gets within its warpath. Now, if South Africa had been a serious vehicle to undermine some of that imperial order and construct, then you could put it in the context of being a crucially important social movement that ranks up in the 20th century. But when it just becomes part of a cog in the wheel, then we need to understand what those forces that came into place that replaced, quote-unquote, apartheid really meant for the social order of the masses of people in the world and for the people of South Africa.
And since we're talking about South Africa, I think we're going to have a special award for the giver. That's right. We want this award to be the Reagan White House, because not a replica of the Pennsylvania Avenue edifice, but a Johannesburg mansion that harkens back to a simpler time when whiteness reigned supreme in Pretoria, to the delight of President Reagan with his constructive engagement. Pay the admission price of 10 rand and hassle the black servants. Demand to see their passbooks and interrogate Nelson Mandela look-alike in the basement cell. Rail against Soviet sponsorship of the African National Congress and denounce as terrorists, just as the Reagan administration did. Conspire with the South African defense minister and the ghost of CIA Director William Casey on how best to maintain illegal control of Namibia and destabilize Angola and Mozambique. Sure, these destabilizations led to hundreds, thousands of deaths, but you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, huh? Yeah, so, Mr. Reagan, that's for your ass.
Now, next, Lappy talks about his concept of restorative justice. Let's check out what he has to say. Dig this.
Well, it's interesting, when we say the word justice in most countries, especially the United States, people mean retribution, or in fact, sometimes they mean revenge. Restorative justice asks a different kind of question. It doesn't say, how can the state punish the offender? It says, how can we restore the relationships that have been broken? And of course, in a country where you have 2 million of your citizens in prison, that's retributive justice at its worst. And of course, the rampant use of the death penalty. But restorative justice seeks to restore relationships that have been broken. It seeks to provide opportunities where victim and offender can meet each other and people can explore the journey they need to travel to make it up to those who have hurt. So, for example, for me, if I met the person who had sent me the letter bomb and they asked for my forgiveness, I would be happy to forgive them, and I would prefer they spent their lives, for example, working in a hospital rather than be locked up in prison. But I might say to them, of course, you would also be willing to help assist me with my needs for the rest of my life as a form of restorative justice, a form of making it up in the ways that are possible. So that's what I think I mean by restorative justice, which is a justice that gives hope. Where often retributive justice simply continues cycles where victims become victimizers.
See, this type of thinking and mentality is what helps legitimize the ruling class. Because if you believe that there's some kind of restorative justice without analyzing the social economic order, then any character that has acted a fool, from a de Klerk to a Reagan, can at the end of the day be forgiven and have some nice little parade for their funeral and stuff. Look, restorative justice is not justice. What it basically does is it subconsciously and consciously, for those who are trying to put this mode of thinking into people's minds, restores the legitimacy of the former colonial imperial apartheid class. That's what this whole thing at the end of the day, it gives legitimacy to a social order that does not deserve it. This is not just about particular individuals. This is silly stuff. When people talk about not all cops are bad or not all soldiers are bad, so you shouldn't speak. When I talk about the role of the raggedy U.S. Empire's soldiers in Iraq, and how I want the U.S. soldiers defeated, it has nothing to do with the individuals' characters who are U.S. soldiers. That's immaterial. It doesn't matter to me if they, pray to some silly invisible man in the sky, Allah, Allah, or Jesus, that's irrelevant. The fact is that if you are a soldier for the U.S., you are carrying out the agenda on a physical level for a U.S. imperial killing machine. That's why you're part of the oppositional order. And there's nothing that can restore justice to an imperial force. So you can't restore any form of justice to an economic order that is based off of inequality. So right now you have a situation that the South African people have the highest disparity of rich and poor anywhere in the world. They have the highest. It's even higher than Guatemala. As if here is not bad enough. But Guatemala is even worse. And South Africa is the worst. Now, how in the hell are you going to have justice in a kind of social order like that? Especially when it's in the third world. So to babble on about restorative justice and getting all to this cosmic slop nonsense, when you have a situation where the masses of black people can't even restore their water supply, that's some sick stuff. There's no legitimacy in the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, a crime Bill Clinton, a Reagan, a de Klerk, a Mandela as president, or any other order that supports their market order.
Yeah, obviously. And I tell you what, there's something else about this restorative justice. Let's take a quick... Very often within the third world, substandard methods and ideologies come up. So, to make easy what they call the transfer of power, okay? So this restorative justice sounds to me like the nonviolence that Dr. King used to preach to us so fervently. You know? Oh, we have to overwhelm them with our capacity to love. I'm not going to be disrespectful to Dr. King, but I have to abuse such a ridiculous notion. Now, this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, well, Tracy, what we got to understand is, in his case, they didn't get the person that sent the letter bomb. But they actually did have real murderers come to the commission and talk some shit about they sorry to real living victims of that abuse. Now, check this out.
Well, you heard him say, just right quick, that if they did find the person who did anyone, the person said he was sorry, he would just want that person to work in a hospital or help him out for the rest of his life since he lost his hands and an eye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's real practical. Well, he'll stab you in your back, you damn fool, the first time you go to sleep. But anyway.
And also say that person is some CEO that's privatizing water. See, you didn't hear him say anything about, well, wait a minute, why don't you be an advocate of deprivatizing water. Yeah. Well, first of all, he knows that order ain't going to play that. They don't play that. They shoot his ass again or blow his ass up again and finish off the job. That's the real world.
See,
since he's coming from this weakened mentality and weakened position, he knows better to approach that class like that because he knows he ain't coming with nothing. So instead, it's, can't we all get along?
Yeah, that old foolishness. It's sad, but they start after they commit crimes against us, they try to put forward substandard solutions. So we get the community aroused behind a police murder. People come out in the thousands, march in the streets. Committees are set up. We all go to court demanding that the cop gets justice. What's justice? It helps if you know. Because all of a sudden they say they're going to give this pig sensitivity training. This has happened, y'all. This has happened.
And also they send out their lap leads. They're called Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. No, it's the truth. You know, after those oinks got off for shooting Amadou Diallo 19 times, they shot Adam 41 times. After that whole thing collapsed and the oinks got off, Al Sharpton man tanned out there and basically
it's all gonna work out.
Just keep, you know, and talked all this nonsense about taking it to a higher order and all of that type of stuff.
And these pigs done got away with a vicious murder.
And Amadou's blood was still wet on the street.
But the sad thing is, and thousands of, I was there when that was building up, thousands of young people who were militantly opposing this and working to bring, you know, people got on buses and went to Albany to sit through the trial. Just so y'all know, that's like being here and getting on a bus to go to L.A. So people, the community was serious about this. And to have someone that they perceive as their leader to give them that kind of foolishness, that's a crime.
And let me explain how the contradiction imploded on itself with Al Sharpton, and how basically, as you can see, it's imploding on Lapley here, who's talking his restorative justice. Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, Louis Farrakhan artists, and other coons, their program basically is a form of black capitalism slash, you know, Negro integration. In other words, you know, this keep your head down and accept whatever the market system crumbs are thrown at you. Now, part of Al Sharpton's overall strategy for abuses that happen in the black community is that what? We need more black faces in high places. You've all heard this before. If we had more Negro cops, if we had more Negro mayors, you know. So in other words, if Master Gabe put on a top hat on a Negro and said, okay, you can run that part of the plantation, and here's a book on how I want you to run it and what developers I want to come run the people out of the community that you're now supposedly running, and da-da-da-da. Well, Al Sharpton helped under this more black faces, more Negro faces in high places. He helped get elected this black district attorney in the Bronx, because that's all part of his program. This is how you solve these problems. So then what happens? 41 bullets happen. So then the black district attorney's job is to get to quote unquote go after these four cops. The problem is that this black district attorney is also a careerist. He also believes in the system and working
right.
In the system. And he knows if he goes after these four white cops aggressively, that's it. No more advancement up up Master's plantation. So, of course, he shoeshines and tap dances during the court. Even though there's all this evidence, you know, the cops are tripping over their story and all of that type of stuff. So, but all these black people were there in court. So Sharpton was on the hot seat because they saw that this Negro was throwing a case. So they said, hey, Sharpton, your boy that you helped get elected and you pitched to us as being part of a solution, he's throwing this case. So then Sharpton called up the Negro and said, hey, man, you throwing this case. He's, you know, you can't be throwing this case. And then the Negro turned back to him and said, look, man, you don't tell me what to do. I'm doing my thing and all of that. In essence, what basically happened was two coons on the plantation striving to get closer to Master's house were fussing amongst themselves because they were trapped by their own ideology. Sharpton said, hey, look at here, boy. You can't be running this stuff like this. This is exposes me. I helped you get elected. And now it's making me look bad. And then the other coon, the black district attorney, said, well, look, if I go after these cops hard, then Massa ain't going to appreciate that. And that'll destroy my career. So what about me? So both of them were trapped within that whole Negro ideology of restorative justiceism. And what do we get?
Betrayal.
Dead. The four.
Betrayal.
White pig cops skipping down the yellow brick road.
That's right. But just one more point on this restorative, this myth of restorative justice. Steve Biko, one of the greatest revolutionary leaders that the black African masses have produced, was murdered. Tortured and then murdered in a cell in South Africa. They know who did it, and they brought those guys into.
Well, actually, let me say, next he's going to talk about. So
okay, all right.
Steve Biko's family and their attitude towards this truth and reconciliation stuff, and amnesty program, and then I'll let you start right off from there.
Okay.
So let's hear what he has to say.
All right.
About since it's Biko's family, so let's see what Lapley has to shoe shine out.
I think I know, of course, Anati Biko is Steve's son. They were not opposed to the Truth Commission. They supported the Truth Commission, but they had very specific opposition to amnesty because they said it would violate their right to a form of justice. The response of our constitutional court was to say, however, that if there were reparations, there would be a form of restorative justice, and that was, in fact, what won the day. But, of course, amnesty is a bitter pill to swallow, but the alternative to amnesty in the South African context was an escalating civil war that would have taken millions of lives. So we did make a compromise, but it's a compromise that opened a democratic space for us to be able to now struggle to create a more just society.
Now you have it. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, actually, not only did they torture and murder Steve Biko, which sparked off the Soweto uprising, but stop and think about this. In most modern capitalist societies, there are laws, and there is one understanding of law, and that is there is no statute of limitation for murder. So when you know the people that committed the murder, why should we accept anything less than the norm? At least the murderers should go to jail. I mean, there's all kind of stuff happened. They beat people up, stole their property, did. But at least the murderers that you actually know for a fact murdered this man should be incarcerated. I'm not even calling for the death penalty, nothing like that. But one day in jail, some acknowledgement that some wrongdoing took place. This restorative justice foolishness, this myth, can lead to madness. Absolute madness.
And see, is this restorative justice, quote unquote, mechanism is the same form of illusion that many people in America live in. They actually believe that this is a self-correcting system, and that all you have to do is tweak it a little bit. Go Democrat, go Republican, and then that within itself brings justice. The class, social, market, imperial order is not even on the table. This is what this lowlife, that's what he is. This is lowlife stuff. That's what he's perpetuating. So he talks about how the Steve Biko family, while they quote-unquote did accept the truth and reconciliation, they had opposition to the amnesty part of it. Well, that's in part because they knew that there would never be any kind of justice if you just have some kind of amnesty without even questioning also the whole market order. So he talks about, the alternative, though, to amnesty would be to have a civil war. In other words, the ruling class said, look, if we're not getting off, then we're willing to throw down and have a civil war. Now, if you have an opposition force that, even in his own words, may possibly cost millions of lives, then you don't have someone who's down with justice. They're saying they're willing to maintain their freedom, even though they committed atrocities and created a system that has produced barbarity. They're willing to plunge the country into civil war to maintain their freedom and some kind of false sense of restorative justice and all of that. In other words, Lampley slithers into is that this was a concession, he admits, but this allowed them to continue on some kind of democratic process. Now look, if millions of people die under a market order system, that's not restorative justice. That's just people dying from capitalism as normal.
Needlessly.
You know, in other words, the status quo is in place and the market order naturally deprives the vast amount of people of being able to survive in any kind of humane way. So if that's what you call restorative justice, because people are trying to pretend that there's true progress being made because black people are being gunned down by an economic order by primarily fools in pinstripe suits and with blue uniforms and badges on, as opposed to Ku Klux Klan uniforms. So we have restorative justice in America because Jim Crow is gone and we're dying from an economic order by people who have pinstripe suits on. In South Africa, they're not dying by the Afrikaners, under the Afrikaners flag. They're dying under the market system ANC's / South African flag. And that's restorative justice. But the game of death for black people is still the same. This guy is a con man at the end of the day.
Look, the truth is that's at bottom. How did they convince people to accept this? Restorative justice, truth commission, hocus pocus. Well, it largely was the ANC and Mr. Mandela. The ANC and Mr. Mandela had enormous moral authority and political authority due to his, along with thousands of others, long imprisonment in the name of the struggle against apartheid. And additionally, the ANC was viewed by the South African masses as the chief organization that fought apartheid for the last 27 years, 30 years, you know, both politically above ground and underground. They used, or if you please, misused that political and moral authority to not only get this truth commission stuff through, but to get people to accept capitalism in ways that they had not formally accepted it. For instance, in Soweto, after the Soweto uprising, people stopped paying rent. And when them South Africans went on a rent strike, they didn't pay no, we talking about 6 month stretches. They ain't pay no rent. The hell with the white man. They didn't pay no water bill. See? So what the apartheid Afrikaner British ruling class wanted to achieve through this deal with the ANC, above all, was what is called in capitalist circles normalcy. They wanted things to go back to normalcy. No soldiers in the street would put a chain on your brain and have you thinking you're supposed to pay for water after you pay taxes and work your butt off your whole life. That you're supposed to pay for them little holes in the wall they renting you.
And now you vote for your own oppression, so that makes
exactly.
you free.
Exactly. And in fact, the South African workers are not totally ignorant of what's going on here. There's people there that think the same way me and Tracy's trying to talk right now. And in fact, they said that the ANC leadership was on the gravy train. Uh-huh. So it's not, people ain't ignorant, but it's a struggle to win the majority. That's what it comes down to.
Now next, Steve Cole, he's the author of the book Ghost Wars. It deals with the CIA, Taliban, and old Bin Laden. He describes the development of the Mujahideen, Bin Laden and company, and the network of terror that has ensued. And of course, it's been perpetuated in this society, this restorative justice society. Check this out.
Well, it, of course, begins in 1979 when the Soviets invaded during the Carter administration, and it really swelled between 1981 and 1985. Essentially, under Bill Casey, the CIA created a three-part intelligence alliance to fund and arm the Mujahideen and to initially to harass Soviet occupation forces, and eventually they embraced the goal of driving them out. And the three-way alliance, each of the parties had a distinct role to play. For the Saudis, their intelligence service primarily provided cash. Each year, the Congress would secretly allocate a certain amount of money to support the CIA's program. After that allocation was complete, the U.S. intelligence liaison would fly to Riyadh, and the Saudis would write a matching check. The U.S. role was to provide logistics and technological support as well as money. And the Saudis really collaborated with Pakistan's intelligence service, ISI, to really run the war on the front line. It was the Pakistani army, and particularly ISI, that picked the political winners and losers in the jihad, and who favored radical Islamist factions because it suited the Pakistan Army's goal of pacifying Afghanistan, a long-time unruly neighbor to the West, whose ethnic Pashtun nationalism the Army feared. And the Army saw Islam not only as a motivating force in the anti-Soviet jihad, but as an instrument of Pakistan's regional policy to control Afghanistan. The U.S. acquiesced with all of this, in part because they thought that the only purpose that brought them to the region was to drive the Soviets out, and they didn't really care about local politics. But also because after Vietnam, the generation of CIA officers involved in this program were scarred by their experiences in Southeast Asia, and they essentially operated under a mantra of no more hearts and minds for us. We're not good at picking winners and losers in the developing world. Let's let the Pakistanis decide who carries this jihad forward. And that's how the favoritism of the radical Islamic factions, I think, was born and nurtured.
All right, so you have a situation, as you heard Steve Cole say, that under the Carter administration, these things got cooking. And as Brzezinski said, they wanted to give the Soviets their Vietnam. And they actually lured the Soviets in there to invade under the Afghan trap. And he talks thoroughly about this in his various books, The Grand Chessboard and things like that, about their global strategy. But my whole point is that, once again, here's a society that officially does not have its apartheid system on the books, i.e. Jim Crow, as it's called in America. But it has helped perpetuate apartheid situations throughout the world, like all imperialist powers do. The Taliban, was nothing but, in essence, a form of an apartheid structure for its little, clique in power, where it would consolidate its little power and authority, segregate out certain portions of the population, like women. You couldn't even go out on the street if you were a female without a male guidance and all of that. Now, of course, they were so poor and wretched, it even hurt them more than anything else. But what I'm saying is that the ethnic divisions that have occurred in that region, the racial intolerance, the religious chauvinisms and extremisms were all perpetuated by a country that at least had the image of being some kind of restorative justice, freedom-loving society. So so even though the U.S. does not have, quote-unquote, Jim Crow laws on the book, if you don't address the market imperial order, then you're just basically walking on with blinders on, because the U.S. has continued after its post-official apartheid period to perpetuate these types of divisions and destructions throughout the planet.
All right. I just wanted to add this, and that is, if you recall, see, part of what we do, we try to also aid in the function of being the memory of the working class and the oppressed. So I want to play in that function. Check this out. When 9-1-1 occurred and those so-called Al-Qaeda people flew the planes into the buildings and all that, somebody went over to Brzezinski and they said, yo, man, you know what? So you put all of this together in terms of putting together the whole deal whereby we first got into Afghanistan to defeat the Soviet Union and all of that. Well, now that these 3,000 Americans done died, how do you feel about it? What do you think? Maybe it was a bad thing? You know, remember what Brzezinski said? He said, listen, 3,000 Americans is a meager price to pay for the bringing down of the Soviet Union. What's wrong with you? And then he said, we can't be concerned about some worked up Arabs. I looked, and this is right after the thing happened. You know, I mean, you know, you might keep your mouth shut. Maybe they got a plan B. You know, I don't know. I mean, but he actually said that shit right on TV of all places. No. Oh, man.
Next, the author of a book that basically talks about the crisis of petroleum, how at least much of the available, easily accessible petroleum is running out and has reached its peak. He talks about the crisis of the energy, at least cheap energy, and that what are its possible ramifications in the very near future. So let's check him out, and let's tie this all together. Dig this.
I've already discussed exploring for oil. I think exploring for oil is will not produce very interesting results. We have pretty much discovered most of the oil that there is to discover. The other point of view, the extreme value, the extreme example of the other point of view is that all fossil fuels are fungible. In other words, you can turn coal into oil, which chemically is true. One can turn coal into oil, and there's an enormous amount of chemical energy stored in the ground in the form of coal. So you run out of oil, you just use something else. And that's where the laws of economics come in. Once the oil, like crude oil, the kind of conventional oil that we've been using up to now, start to become expensive enough, then other sources of hydrocarbons become economically competitive. And that's already happening. For example, oil sands in Alberta are being mined now at a profit. Of course, these are solid deposits. They don't gush out of the ground. You have to mine them, strip mine them, and extract the oil from the ore. And so they're not going to flood the market anytime soon. They come on very slowly, but still, they're being mined at a profit. And there are there's a long list of other hydrocarbons that can be turned into fuel at a price. So what we're talking about is not the end of the availability of fuels. We're talking about the end of the availability of cheap fuel. But you have to understand that our civilization has evolved because of the has evolved into the form that it has because of the availability of cheap fuel, not just the availability of fuel. Another point that's extremely important to understand is that if we go on burning fossil fuels with complete abandon, we risk doing irreversible damage to the climate of our planet. It just happens to be the only planet we have.
Okay, now, part of the reason why I threw that in there is that from a planetary concept, you can't have or even pretend to have any kind of justice in a society where the environment and the social order is being destroyed by the market forces that, one, want to continue to perpetuate the world economies into a fossil fuel system. They want to maintain it there. They don't want to develop solar energy, wind power, or alternative energies because they make their loot in fossil energy. So the cheap access to this is running out, which is going to perpetuate wars, just like there's going to be wars over water. At the same time, the maintenance of us in this dead energy system is having devastating effects on the planet. This is not even debated anymore about some of the global warming effects and other things that are taking place.
They make movies about it.
So here you have a situation where if all your little worldview is on a narrow form of restorative justice, that basically means pushing one thug for another but not tackling the market order, then you don't even know what real human rights, social justice, economic justice for humans and other living species even means. You're just babbling. And that's, in essence, part of the problem with these forms of mystical restorative justice philosophers. But as we wrap this up, to show how you can never have any real form of restorative justice to make this concrete in this market economic order, here is a, well, just another case of an empire gone mad. Here's Ashcough being asked some questions, but refusing to discuss or turn over the documents about Boy George and his administration, who 2 years ago were saying that they could ignore international law that forbade torture of inmates that they picked up. Now, here's a Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy asking Mad Dog Ashcough about this. And let's see how restorative justice Ashcough responds. Dig this.
In the front page of the Times, it has this quote: a team of administration lawyers concluded in a March 2000 late legal memorandum, President Bush was not bound either by international treaty prohibiting torture or by federal anti-torture law because he has the authority as commander-in-chief to approve any techniques needed to protect the nation's security. Do you agree with that conclusion?
Senator Kennedy, I'm not going to try and issue hypothetical.
I'm not asking hypothetical. This is a memoranda that again was referred today in the Post, August 2002. Justice Department advised the White House that torturing Al-Qaeda terrorists in captivity abroad may be justified and that international laws against torture may be unconstitutional if applied to interrogations. Do you agree with that?
I am not. First of all, this administration rejects torture.
I'm asking you whether this is. There are three memoranda. January 9, 2002, signed by John Yeo. The August 2002 Justice Department, the Bybee Amendment memo, and the March 2003, the Interagency Working Group. Those are three memoranda. Will you provide those to the committee?
No, I will not.
General, has the president authorized you to invoke the executive privilege today on these documents?
I am not going to reveal discussions, whether I've had them or not had them with the president. He asked me to deal with him as a matter of confidence. I have not invoked executive privilege today. I have explained to you why I'm not turning over the documents.
Well, what are you invoking?
I have not invoked anything. I have just explained to you why I'm not turning over the documents.
Thank you very much. Well, General, that means you may be in contempt of Congress then. You got to have a reason not to answer our questions. As you know, when you're sitting up here, there may be a rationale for executive privilege that misses the point, but you know, you have to have a reason. You are not allowed under our Constitution not to answer our questions. And that ain't constitutional.
Now, in a society that had true justice,
Ashcroft
would have been
up.
Ran out and locked up, thrown out, dragged out in chains. But in a restorative justice society,
yeah.
You tap dance, allow obvious contempt and obvious belligerence and obvious neglect from the laws and order that they say they stand for.
That's right.
Meanwhile, you got the masses of people running around, circling over some raggedy dead stiff's coffin with a raggedy blood-drenched flag drenched over it and stuff. As I said before, true justice would have included Boy George getting in that coffin along with Jerry Brown, Condoleezza Rice, Chalabi, Osama bin Laden, Jesse Jackson, all Hebrew Zionists, Islamic Zionists, Christian Zionists, Bill O'Reilly, the OPD, Jeb Bush, Catherine Harris.
That list gets shot along, brother.
Cheney, Rumsfeld, colon cancer, and Condoleezza Rice, and a few other fuels that you know I could come up with.
That's our form of justice. Only the dead are forgiven.
And mark my word, it won't be too long.
Extraordinary. When the Center for Constitutional Rights got the April memo, April memo 2003, we were just, it popped our eyes off, because what it says is really something I never expected to see. It says that the president in his commander-in-chief powers is exempt from laws in the United States that prohibit torture, is exempt from the torture convention which the United States ratified, and as commander-in-chief he can basically take whatever actions he wants to defend the United States. I call that the Pinochet defense. I call it the Troy argument, that you can essentially sack a city, kill all the men, sell everybody into slavery. If you can do anything, that's what he can do. So it basically turns on its head 1,000 years of law, and it just makes you think, what was the annex attached to that document? That document had an annex of what the interrogation techniques were supposed to be. That's one of the issues that came up in the hearing with Ashcroft yesterday, and that's what we want to see. Other things, that was one of the critical documents, is those interrogation techniques, which everybody now in the press, all of a sudden, of course, compared to 2 years ago when we knew about these, some of this torture, now all of a sudden the press is all over this trying to get that document. But Ashcroft so far has refused it. It's an important document. It's not the end-all and the be-all, but it's going to show at least a number of the techniques that I believe will constitute torture. There is, as was explained in the hearing, you have to take executive privilege to not turn it over. He didn't do that. It was it was part of the executive holding a document as opposed to him himself, the president, saying, I have a right to hold this document. That doesn't mean he could hold it in all cases, but at least it sets up the privilege. It can be overcome. If Nixon had tried to withhold the Watergate tapes, the court then said you have to turn them over. Not a valid invocation of the privilege. But he didn't even get there. So what's really going on here? What's really going on here is an incredible cover-up of illegality by our government at the highest levels, in my belief. Memo has Rumsfeld's name on the cover. It also says something really interesting. If our soldiers or if our people are going to do this kind of conduct, it might be best to shield them with a presidential order or directive. So it indicates on page 24 of the document that a presidential directive would be very helpful here. So that's the other document you want to see here. Is there a presidential directive? Look, it's not going to say go torture people, but in my view, it may very well say these are techniques that are authorized to be used, which many lawyers will then say constitute either torture or cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. It's an extraordinary memo. If people want to see it, we have it linked on our website as a PDF file. It's ccr-ny.org. You can go there, look at pages 21 to 24. If you think this country is going in a bad way, this will confirm your worst fears. The president is exempt from all criminal laws in the United States with regard to when he has the commander-in-chief power fighting a war. In other words, he's exempt from all law, which is why the example of what happened to Troy is not outside here, because that's what he's really saying. He's saying, in a war, I can do anything. In a war, there's no Geneva Conventions. In a war, there's no convention against torture. In a war, there's nothing about no law at all. I can do whatever I want. I can pick up you tomorrow, put you in a brig, torture you, and do whatever I want, and it can be justified in the name of national security. And that isn't what this memo is about. This memo isn't saying ticking time bomb. This memo is saying, as a general matter, the president is exempt from using laws that prohibit torture, is exempt from those laws. Justice Ginsburg turns to Paul Clement, the assistant solicitor, and says, well, what if you used mild torture? Paul Clement says, well, the United States doesn't engage in torture. And then the key words to me in this whole thing, trust us, trust us. That's the way our government is trying to sell its war in Iraq, the abuse in Abu Ghraib, what's happening in Guantanamo, trust us. Well, it's obvious they can't be trusted. They can't be trusted at all. They need a court looking at them. They need Congress looking at them. And then they need the people of America going after them. I did see two of my clients, Shafiq and Razul, in the United Kingdom. They were released because what they did is they falsely confessed to meeting Osama bin Laden when their pictures were shown. The government claimed it was their pictures in a video. After 3 months of interrogation, 3 months of isolation, dogs, chained to the floor for 12 hours, food, deprivation, the whole business, loud noises, they falsely confessed. Only after British intelligence proved that they were in England at the time the video was made were they released. It just shows you, first of all, how useless this kind of stuff is, how harmful it is, and that we shouldn't ignore what's happening in Guantanamo, even though we're very focused on Iraq right now. These little investigations going on around seven lower-level soldiers in Abu Ghraib, you know, that's just not what this is about anymore. It's clear that the opening to lawlessness in this administration came from the very top. It came not just in the memos we're talking about. It came in that early Gonzales, counsel to the president, memo to the president, apparently, that said you can ignore the Geneva Conventions in Afghanistan and you can ignore them because we don't want to be subjected to war crimes. This stuff goes all the way up. We've got to get to the bottom of it. It's I consider it a major crisis of the Republic, a major crisis of democracy. My favorite parts of the reading is one of the lawyers who represents the Guantanamo detainees. The government comes into court and says, we have no jurisdiction over Guantanamo. It's outside the sovereignty of the United States. Courts can't hear any cases coming out of Guantanamo. But for purposes of the criminal statute prohibiting torture, because it only applies outside the United States, they're going to make the argument that Guantanamo now is inside the United States in terms of that statute. So you don't have to go very much farther to say they're doing nothing but manipulating the law to essentially allow themselves to be not prosecuted for torture and to allow themselves to essentially leave people in total legal limbo out on Guantanamo. That's an extraordinary moment we've reached. I mean, really the worst that I've seen in this republic really since I've been a lawyer. Well, I spent 8 years, really, of my life fighting everything and everything Reagan did in Central America. We brought lawsuits in El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Grenada, each area in which the president really used troops illegally, in which there was torture going on. The torture memo in particular, I mean the torture book in particular, it came out of the School of the Americas, which instructed Latin American dictators and others in torture. That kind of stuff was going on with the Contras in Nicaragua. One of our clients, Ben Linder, who was killed by the Contras, a young man building a dam, an engineer in Nicaragua, many people think was tortured while he was lying on the ground. It was used in Central America. It was used in Nicaragua. So, and we tried to put an end to it. They withdrew it. And then now we see this going again. How you do torture? You know, what do? You sit the person in the chair, you put him in a funny position, you use electroshock, you use, you know, you threaten his family. Given out by the CIA to interrogators in Nicaragua, that's correct. And it was, and so this is apple pie, unfortunately, for many of our intelligence agencies. We thought we maybe had created some space that it wasn't happening, and now we see not only is it happening, but it's being justified. In other words, when you caught the CIA with this torture manual, that was embarrassing. But they didn't try and say the president has the power to torture people. Here, that's what they're saying. The president has the power by directive to torture people. But really, when I see what's going on with Reagan right now, and I see the slaughter that took place in Nicaragua, we brought a case about a woman named Myrna Cunningham, who was a doctor, Mosquito Indian doctor in northern Nicaragua, suing Reagan and all his cohorts, saying they basically backed the Contras and they backed them in a war of terror and torture. She was raped scores of times purposely as a form of torture to discourage her from supporting the Sandinistas. That's the man who died. That's the man who was responsible for what happened in Nicaragua. The highest levels, what they did was back the Contras, set up an illegal Contra force to go into Nicaragua, fight against the legitimate government of Nicaragua. Then when you had a Boland Amendment come down, an amendment prohibiting U.S. aid into the Contras, Reagan essentially, with a plan with Oliver North and others, went around that amendment, that restriction, and still illegally funded the Contras. In fact, we brought a lawsuit trying to compel prosecution of Reagan for that. And then, of course, it led to Iran-Contragate, which was the trading of missiles to Iran, the money then diverted to the Contras. Reagan's little memo book says in it, sold missiles to Iran. Completely illegal under the law to sell missiles at that time to Iran, completely illegal to fund the Contras. And here's what we did. We basically set up this force, trained them in the United States, sent them into Nicaragua, slaughtered thousands of people, and overturned the government. I mean, is that the man we're honoring today?
Now, that's the capitalist version of restorative justice. Whereas you heard throughout the show, Ashcoff thinks he's exempt from true justice. The apartheidists think they're exempt from true justice. Reagan think, and his minions who propagate the illusion of him being some kind of decent, noble character, think that he and his past is exempt from true justice. Well, not only will these demons be running from our bullets in the end, but even old Reagan right now, I'm quite sure he's running from the devil. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.